And this is the story of the man born blind. He doesn't get a name, and as I was preparing this message, I often wish that John gave this man a name, so I didn't have to say the man born blind 10,000 times. But that's all right, the man born blind. Now, everyone knows what a make or break moment is. Make or break moment. It's when the chips are down, the stakes are high, and you got to make a choice. You have to show up or ship out, as they say. We see this in sports. Let's say it's basketball, and there's not enough time to get the ball inside for an easy shot. So you have to take the three. Are they going to make it? Who knows? Or football, down by two. And you know what? That field goal just isn't going to cut it after the touchdown. You need the two-point conversion to tie it up and go into overtime. These are make-or-break moments. For me personally, it was a sports thing. I wrestled in high school, and it was my senior year. It was the last time that I knew I was going to wrestle because state was the next thing, and I highly doubted that I would make it past that tournament to state. But at the tournament, there was one person in particular who I had wrestled several times throughout the three years of high school. We did 10, 11, 12, not 9 through 12. So yes, 3 years of high school. His name was Gavin Fazio. So Gavin, if you're listening, or if you know Gavin Fazio, thank him. You'll find out later why. Anyway, he had beaten me every single time that we wrestled for 3 years. Every time we wrestled, he would just, wipe the floor with me. And so I knew, the stakes are down. I don't have a great track record wrestling this guy. Terrible one. And so with that in mind, I had a choice. And maybe he was having a bad day. Maybe he just got over the flu. I don't know. But somehow I managed to pin him in the second round, and it was just made. That moment was a make for me. And the highlight of my career of wrestling, which is to say very little. But anyway, in the book of John, in chapter 9, we have a series of make or break moments, and it's all about the identity of Jesus. Jesus, as Ethan read, he says he's the light of the world. And we're going to see what that means when this light encounters different people. It's going to reveal something. And there'll have to be a response. And we're going to see what that is. So, the first seven verses, we're setting the scene. That Jesus is passing by. He's actually finished up at the Feast of Booths in chapters 7 through 8. He's at the Feast of Booths. And now, he's left and he's passing by. He sees a man born blind. He heals him, and in a very curious way. And this is a little bit of a side note, but for those of you who maybe are neat freaks or really like to be clean, you might think this is weird that Jesus spits on the ground and he makes mud, a paste, and he puts it on his eyes. This is something that Jesus is doing to reenact creation. When God makes man, he stoops down and he takes the dust and he forms it and he makes a man. And then he breathes life into it. And so Jesus is, he's signaling to his audience that he is the creator, like we found out in John 1. He's created. And also, later in the book, you'll see Jesus breathing on the disciples, and you're like, oh, kind of weird, Jesus. Like, isn't it enough just to, point and make it happen? He's breathing on them because that's what happened in the beginning. God breathed into Adam, and he became a human being with a soul. And so Jesus, in these very short verses at the beginning, he's saying that he is creator. And that's something that we can't miss in the book of John. So with that out of the way, the man born blind, he's healed. And throughout this chapter, we're going to see a progressive understanding of who Jesus is, a progressive enlightening. He may have physical sight, but he doesn't quite understand who Jesus is yet. He'll get there. Conversely, you have the Pharisees and the religious establishment. And they're going to start out with a divided opinion. And as the chapter progresses, we're going to see that they've been blind the whole time to who Jesus is. So let's take it up again in verse 8. The neighbors and those who had seen him before as a beggar were saying, "Is this not the man who used to sit and beg?" Some said, "It is he." Others said, "No, but he is like him." He kept saying, "I am the man." So they said to him, "Then how are your eyes open?" He answered, "The man called Jesus made mud and anointed my eyes and said to me, 'Go to Siloam and wash.' So I went and washed and received my sight." They said, "Where is he?" He said, "I don't know." There's some funny things in here that I want to just, you know, maybe show you if you missed them. There are actually a couple funny things in like humorous, not interesting, but humorous, to show people's obtuse lack of understanding of Jesus and his works. The first is this. You have these people who are debating, and they're like, "Oh, man, who is that guy? Looks like the guy used to sit here and beg." "No, he looks like him. It's not that guy." And then you have the actual person who's sitting in the corner like, "Hey, yep, it was me. Like, pick me. Like, I know. Hello, it was me." And they're just kind of oblivious. It's like walking into a conversation and, you know, they're talking about you and you're like, "Oh, hey, yep, I'm standing right here. Standing right here." They're oblivious to it. And then they're like, oh, okay, we see you. And then they said, "Well, where is he?" Now, I'm not a scientist. I'm not a doctor. I don't know much about eyes, but I do know that if someone is blind and then they're healed and they don't have sight in the meantime, so I'm thinking, like, how will he know where Jesus is if he's blind? I thought it was really funny. But it's like, where was he? I don't know. I was blind. Like, you tell me. You have two eyes. I just got these. So the first thing that the man born blind says, he's a man. The man Jesus. The man called Jesus. He made the mud and anointed my eyes. Right now, his understanding is that Jesus is a man. It's not wrong. That's right. It's not a full picture yet. It's not close. And you see that there's division amongst the neighbors and those who'd seen him before. Let's continue. We're bringing in the big guns for this next section. They brought to the Pharisees the man who had formerly been blind. Now it was a Sabbath day when Jesus made the mud and opened his eyes. So the Pharisees again asked him how he had received his sight. And he said to them, "He put mud on my eyes and I washed and I see." Some of the Pharisees said, "This man is not from God, for he does not keep the Sabbath." But others said, "How can a man who is a sinner do such signs?" And there was a division among them. So they said again to the blind man, "What do you say about him, since he has opened your eyes?" He said, "He is a prophet." So it doesn't take a rocket surgeon to notice what's happening. There's division amongst the Pharisees. Glad if someone caught that rocket. You don't operate on rockets. That's silly. You do chemistry on rockets. Okay, so there's a division amongst the Pharisees. They can't make up their mind. This is classic. Classic Pharisees, classic John. They can't make up their mind. Chapter 6 through 8, people are arguing back and forth. He's a sinner. He has a demon. Well, when the Messiah comes, is he going to do more signs than this guy? No one can get a clear idea of who Jesus is, especially not these guys. But what does the man born blind see? He's a prophet. That's good. First, Jesus starts out as a man. And then, he's a prophet. So we're seeing a progression. And the Pharisees, they're not like super, like they're wrong, but they're not as wrong as they could be. So let's give them that credit for a minute, you know. Also, if you've noticed this, I'm handing out points actually for the close readers of John. They're not redeemable for anything. But the close reader of John will know something special about this, about the Sabbath. This is not the first Sabbath healing in the book of John. This is number two. And it was the first Sabbath healing that prompted the Jewish leadership to seek to kill Jesus. So you think Jesus would, like, take a hint? Because he knows they're seeking to kill him. That was the point of the controversy back in chapters 6 through 8. Why are you seeking to kill me? Who's seeking to kill you? You have a demon. And then they're like, oh yeah, well, we kind of are seeking to kill you. And they throw stones at him. That's his last stage exit, is attempted murder. And so you think that he would lay low. He wouldn't heal on the Sabbath because people had a cow about that. And this is going to be important because the Sabbath is going to come back and we're going to compare the sick man and the blind man. So put that in your pocket. Remind me if I miss it. I won't miss it, I promise. But that's what we're going to get at. So extra points for people who caught that the first time. So he says Jesus is a prophet. Pharisees are saying maybe he's from God. Or they're saying he's not from God, or maybe he's not from God. They don't say things in the positive, they say things in the negative. Maybe he's not from God. Okay, thank you, very clear. Now, let us continue. We're in verses 18 through 23. We're going to bring the parents onto the scene. And Jesus, in a very clever way, he introduced just about everyone in this story back in the first couple verses. Who sinned, this man or his parents? It was neither this man or his parents who sinned, but so that the works of God might be displayed in him. And this is what we're seeing. We're seeing the works of God being displayed in this blind man. So now, the Jews did not believe that he had been blind and had received his sight until they called the parents of the man who had received his sight and asked them, "Is this your son who you say was born blind? How then does he now see?" His parents answered, "We know that this is our son and that he was born blind." Check. Good job, parents. "But how he now sees, we do not know, nor do we know who opened his eyes. Ask him. He is of age. He will speak for himself." If you stop there, you're like, okay, they're doing a little bit of, you know, encouragement. You know, kick him out of the nest. Like, stand on your own two legs and fly a little bit. That's not the case, we're going to find in the next verse. His parents said these things because they feared the Jews. For the Jews had already agreed that if anyone should confess Jesus to be Christ, he was to be put out of the synagogue. Therefore, his parents said, "He is of age, ask him." So they're doing this out of fear. They're responding out of fear. And this, I would say, is where the climax of the story begins, because all the cards are on the table. We can't hide behind any doubt. Well, maybe this man was playing the long con, and he was, you know, trying to deceive everybody and just being a beggar because it was easy. Maybe he wasn't actually blind. But now you have the blind man and his parents asserting that, no, he was. And they have to wrestle with this. His parents do, he does, the man born blind, and the Pharisees. It's all on the table. That is what we know. So this is the make or break, right? We know that Jesus healed. They cannot hide behind doubt. They cannot hide behind skepticism. They cannot hide behind what ifs. They're confronted with the reality that Jesus healed. He said he is the light of the world, and he gives light to somebody. He opens their eyes. He said that back in chapter 7. He says it again right now. He's verified that. And this is how the light of the world works. It's going to expose their hearts because there's nothing to hide behind. This is the work that God is doing in the blind man that will reveal the hearts of the people in this chapter. So no one has an excuse. And this is the make or break point. We have a crisis. If they give Jesus a positive verdict, then they're out of the synagogue. And this isn't just like if you disagree with your pastor, he's kicking you out on the road and you just have to go down two blocks to the next church. This is a synagogue. It's not something that is a dime a dozen. It's not like Bank of America, First Church, Second Church. This is your community. This is where your family's at. You notice his parents are at the same place. This is where his parents are. It's not the temple. This is a place where they go and get teaching. But being cast out of here is a big deal. It's a social blow. It's stepping down in status. So something is at stake. And in the moment, the make or break moment, what do his parents do? They choke. They would rather throw their son, keep their seat in the synagogue, than give a positive verdict on Jesus. And that reveals their heart. It reveals their priorities, where they're standing, what they desire. Hint, they desire the glory that comes from men more than the glory that comes from God. And that is always going to get in the way of belief. So all the cards are on the table. It's make or break. And now enter the Pharisees. They're going to have a showdown with the man born blind. And we'll see who is really blind and who is really sighted. This is verse 24. So for the second time, they called the man who had been blind and said to him, "Give glory to God. We know that this man is a sinner." He answered, "Whether he is a sinner, I do not know. One thing I do know, that though I was blind, now I see." They said to him, "What did he do to you? How did he open your eyes?" He answered them, "I've told you already, and you would not listen. Why do you want to, hear it again?" Oh. He answered, "Do you want to hear it again? Do you also want to become his disciples?" There's the humor I was talking about. And they reviled him, saying, "You are his disciple, but we are disciples of Moses. We know that God has spoken to Moses, but it's for this man. We do not know where he comes from." The man answered, "Why, this is an amazing thing. You do not know where he comes from, and yet he opened my eyes. We know that God does not listen to sinners, but if anyone is a worshiper of God and does his will, God will listen to him. Never since the world began has it been heard that anyone opened the eyes of a man born blind. If this man were not from God, he could do nothing." They answered him, "You were born in utter sin, and would you teach us?" And they cast him out. Showdown. We'll start with the Pharisees because there's a lot there. They're revealing their blindness. They're revealing their lack of vision, their sightlessness, their darkened minds. It's funny that they should say that they appeal to Moses. They say, "We're Moses' disciples." Because it's back in chapter 5 where Jesus says, "You don't even understand what Moses was writing about. If you did, you would believe me." And they're still hanging on to their blind interpretation of Moses without Jesus. Also, another thing they get wrong. This man is not from God. And this is more points, I promise. More points for people who are close readers of John. Go back to chapter 3. There's a leader from the Pharisees who approaches Jesus at night. And he has something, he says something to Jesus that is very telling. Now, he's not just a Pharisee. He is a leader of the Pharisees. Jesus calls him the teacher of Israel. So he speaks for his class when he says something. This is what he says. "Rabbi, we know that you are a teacher come from God. For no one can do these things that you do unless God is with him." Huh. And in chapter 9 now, this man's not from God. He's a sinner. Make up your minds, guys. Make up your minds. So the beginning, the Pharisees, as Nicodemus, he's like, even he gets it. And he doesn't, he's left in the dark after the conversation with Jesus. That's right, guys. Comes to Jesus at night, he leaves in the dark. That's the pun. Ba-dum-tsh. Thanks. Anyway, the youth get tired of it, I'm sure. That's when you say, "No, it's funny every time." Cool. Thanks, Katie. So they've already said, right? Nicodemus has already declared that you must be a teacher from God, because no one can do these signs unless God is with him. And then right now in chapter 9, they go back on that statement and saying, "No, he's not from God. He's a sinner." So they're showing their regression. They're regressing into blindness. man, it's just full of ignorance. Also, they say, you were born in utter sin. What did we just talk about at the beginning of the chapter? Who sinned? This man or his parents, that he was born this way? No, neither. It was so the works of God might be revealed. And they're still thinking in the wrong categories, that it was because he sinned or because his parents sinned. So every step of the way, they're not getting it, and it's going over their head. They're blind to it. This is their break moment. Make or break? Break. Parents of the man born blind? Nope. Pharisees? Nope. But what about the man born blind? What is he coming to realize? And this is funny. He's like, oh, you want to be his disciples? Like, that's sarcasm. That's sarcasm in your Bibles. It's a biting statement meant to expose foolishness. And that is what the man born blind is doing. Oh, you want me to tell it again? I already told you. What does he think about Jesus? He said, God has to be with him because no one can do these things unless God is with him. He is from God. So we have, at the very beginning, he's a man. Then he's a prophet. And then he's from God. And there's something else that will come to you that's missing. So he's getting it. He's seeing the picture. And the Pharisees are losing their sight. They're becoming blind. Let's keep reading. This is verse 35. Jesus heard that they cast him out. And having found him, he said, do you believe in the Son of Man? He answered, and who is he, sir, that I may believe in him? Jesus said to him, you have seen him, and it is he who is speaking to you. He said, Lord, I believe. And he worshiped him. We get to see the man born blind, his faith on full display. The light of the world shines on him, gives him sight, and he responds in worship. He responds in worship. The Son of Man, the figure in Daniel 7, the human-like figure who receives authority and power from God and rules with him and receives worship from all tongues and nations. That's Daniel 7. So this is Jesus saying he is the Son of Man, and that is the proper response. The man born blind, he sees and he worships. Every sight, every clear vision of Jesus will result in worship. It has to, or else it's not clear vision. It's not there yet. But this guy, the blind guy gets it. The blind guy sees it. And that's irony for you, right? He understands. Now, I told you to keep something in your pocket. Anyone remember what that was? Your keys, your wallet. It was the Sabbath healing back in chapter 5. And we're meant to compare these two. Two healings on the Sabbath. Chapter 5. It's the man who's sitting at the pool for 38 years. Jesus asks, do you want to be well? Oh, I don't have anyone to help me into the pool. And the water does its thing without me. I don't know. Jesus heals him. Take up your mat and walk. Okay. Got it. Jesus heals him. The Pharisees ask, who is it who healed you? I don't know. Jesus finds him later in the temple. Remember where it is. It's in the temple. See, you're well. Sin no more, that nothing worse may happen to you. And what does the man do? He goes straight to the authorities and says, oh, yep, Jesus, that guy. Yep, he's the Sabbath breaker. Get him. Like, it wasn't me. Like, don't put this on me. He sells Jesus out to the Pharisees as soon as he finds out Jesus' identity. He sells him out. Now, what does a man born blind do? It's the same situation. It's on the Sabbath. He might be accused of breaking the Sabbath if he's washing his face. And there's a lot at stake. He might get cast out of the synagogue if he confesses Jesus to be the Christ. So what does the man born blind do, right? Jesus heals him. They ask him, where is this person who healed you? I don't know. He was blind. I don't know. And then Jesus finds him. Where does he find him afterwards? It's not in the temple. It's not in the synagogue. It's only after he is cast out of the synagogue. And I think that in these comparisons, it's getting at an important point. Is that when belief means rejection, we will either worship or we'll walk away. The sick man in chapter 5, he walked away. Faced with, you know, maybe Sabbath violations, I'm out. That's too rich for my blood. But the man born blind, when belief meant rejection, he was still all in and he worshiped. So when belief means rejection, we're going to worship or walk away. There's no third way about it. And think about the purpose of the book of John. These things are written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name. He is trying to persuade us to believe. And it's encouraging to note that on the outside is where Jesus is. So if we find ourselves on the outside, we can take comfort. We can be encouraged because that's where Jesus is with his people. Finally, the last couple verses. In the book of John, there's a connection between light and a connection between judgment. Light and judgment go hand in hand. This isn't the Matthew 5, let your light shine so that they may see your good works and glorify your Father who is in heaven. This is not an homage to the Newsboys' 1994 hit, Shine. This is a light of judgment, a light of exposure. So, Jesus says at the beginning of the chapter, while I'm in the world, I'm the light of the world. And at the end of the chapter, he says this, for judgment I came into this world, that those who do not see may see, and those who see may become blind. Some of the Pharisees near him heard these things and said to him, are we also blind? Jesus said to them, if you were blind, you would have no guilt. But now that you say, we see, your guilt remains. There's something in the Pharisees that is preventing them from believing. I'm going to do a little cheating. I'll tell you what it is. And I'm going to use the Bible to do that. I guess it's not really cheating, but this is in John 3. This is in the conversation with Nicodemus. And this is the judgment. Verse 19, the light has come into the world, and people love the darkness rather than the light because their works were evil. For everyone who does wicked things hates the light and does not come to the light, lest his works should be exposed. But whoever does what is true comes to the light, so that it may be clearly seen that his works have been carried out in God. There is a sin that is getting in the way of their belief. What is the sin? They are dishonoring the Son. They don't believe the Son, and they are claiming to know the Father. If they are dishonoring the Son and they claim to know the Father, they're actually dishonoring the Father because they're dishonoring the one who sent him. And that's the relationship between Jesus and the Father. It's why he says you don't understand the Father is because you don't understand what I'm saying. That tells me that the Father has not drawn you, that you're not of his line, that you're actually of your father, the devil. So you can read back in chapter 6 through 8, and you can get all that wonderful dialogue. But Jesus comes into the world as a light of the world, and that's a make or break point for people. Not point break, make or break point. This is when Jesus shines and people have to respond. And the Pharisees turn in on themselves. They don't want to come into the light. They don't want to admit that they are blind. They claim to see. They claim to know God. And that makes them culpable. It makes them guilty because they have Jesus right in front of them, healing a blind man so that the works of God might be displayed. And that's what Jesus said. Like, that's the light of the world shining, is the healing of the blind man. And people's response to that is going to reveal their hearts. Belief or unbelief. No other way about it. So, when belief means rejection, we can either worship or walk away? And what might be some indicators that we're in danger of walking away? And now I know most of us, if not, I can't say for everyone, I can only say for myself, know the Lord. Most of us do. And so what I want to leave you with is not a burden that you have to question your salvation, but rather a inventory to see, how am I doing? Am I worshiping? Am I walking faithfully? Am I in danger of compromising in some areas? And if you don't know the Lord, please hear these as warnings and as an invitation to come and know the one who can save you. So, one indicator that we might be compromising in some areas or walking away is we like what Jesus gives us, but not what he asks of us. We like what he gives, not what he asks. If I may permit a tour of John, at least the first 10 chapters. In chapter 6, Jesus feeds the 5,000, and people see it. In fact, some of his disciples, other than the 12, are delivered through a terrible storm, and Jesus walks on the water out to them later in the chapter, and then they get to the land that they're going. He feeds them. He delivers them from the storm. They want him to be their king. He says, no, it's awkward, but it's okay. And then later in the chapter, he says, unless you eat the flesh of the Son of Man and drink his blood, you have no life in you. And it's at that point they say, ooh, we really like the bread, but this is a hard saying. Who can listen to it? And many of his disciples no longer walked with him. So they like the bread. They like not dying in the storm. But when he says, you know, unless you eat the flesh of the Son of Man and drink his blood, you have no life in you, they don't really like that. And that shows unbelief. The walking away, and they walked away. So for us, maybe it's like we like being saved. Thank God for that. We like that he has blessed us with a good house or a good community. What about like washing your brother's or sister's feet? A humble service that Jesus will show later in the book of John. I don't know about that. Or elsewhere in the Gospels, it's take up your cross and follow me. But what do I have to give up? Do I have to give that up, Jesus? Do I have to give up my comfy location, my house? I don't know. That's a lot to ask. So we like what he gives us, but not so much what he asks of us. Another indicator, and I think this is right on the money of where we are in the book of John, is we like the glory that comes from people more than the glory that comes from God. This is the reason that the people back in chapter 5 that they don't believe is because they receive glory that comes from one another. This is in chapter 5. How can you believe when you receive glory from one another and do not seek the glory that comes from the only God? And later in chapter 12, now, sometimes we think that, you know, the Pharisees were bad through and through and no one believed in Jesus and they just wanted to kill him. Maybe that's just me. I don't know. Sometimes I think that. And then I read passages like this and I'm really surprised. I'm like, I don't remember that passage. That's amazing. John 12. Read through John 12 in, not now, but some point. This is John 12. This is 42 and 43. Nevertheless, many even of the authorities believed in him, but for fear of the Pharisees, they did not confess it, so that they would not be put out of the synagogue. For they loved the glory that comes from man more than the glory that comes from God. That will kill belief. Many even of the authorities believed, but they didn't confess it, and so they weren't counted among the community of believers. It was too costly. The confession was just too costly. The rent was too high. The confession, you just couldn't do it. Can't go there, Jesus. I can't. So it's the glory that comes from other people. Would I rather be recognized as one of my peers or would I rather be recognized as Jesus's, as a Christian? Would I rather be associated with this particular group of people, or would I rather be associated with the church, with Jesus? We're like, oh, I don't, it's in it. It can be hard. It can be tempting at times to want to distance yourself from people. But the glory that comes from people, it's craving the approval that comes from others that says, okay, yeah, we accept you. You do things on our terms, we accept you. And sometimes it is tempting to cave into that rather than the approval that comes from God. Man born blind's parents, that's what they caved into. Pilate, his political career was on the line, and people were getting a little rowdy. He's like, all right, I'll wash my hands of it. He was afraid. And the sick man, back in chapter 5, he wanted the glory that came from man. He caved to the fear and the pressure. He sold Jesus out. It might be perhaps why 60% of my age group stops attending church after doing so regularly as a teenager. After college or during college, 60% of millennials drop off. And it's a shame and it's a tragedy. And there are many different theories about why this happens, like what the church needs to do. But at the core, and I think that, yeah, there are some great proposals of problems, but at the core, at some point, each person takes their faith and puts it on the back burner and says, it's easier for me to be a part of this crowd than the church. It's easier for me to be a part of these people than it is for me to be God's. So loving the glory that comes from people more than the glory that comes from God. Now for encouragement, worshipful responses is, where is your heart at? Is your heart looking for the glory that comes from God? And that is a glory that is a service glory. It's a John the Baptist saying, he must increase, but I must decrease. It's washing one another's feet. It's shaped like a cross. In the book of John, glory is always looking forward to the cross. Jesus says, my hour is not yet come. But the hour of glory is the hour that Jesus is showing the Father on the cross as love for enemies. God so loved the world that he sent his only son that whoever would believe in him would not perish but have eternal life. That is the glory revealed on the cross. Is that a glory that is a desire for you? To be humble and low and used by God to love a world that hates him and that will hate us. So this isn't a glory that exalts itself. It's a glory that it's humble. Another worshipful response, and I think that John the Baptist, man, he just gets it, is confessing it out loud to others. Where the Pharisees, or some of the authorities believe, but they did not confess it. To me, that says there's kind of two parts of belief. One, acknowledging the truth of Jesus as who he says he is, and confessing it as our dependence, as our truth, as our life, as our source of salvation and strength. It's what separates us from demons, right? They believe, but are they confessing it? No. They believe, but they're not worshiping. That is what separates us. And so are we confessing? Is that something that comes out of our mouth that we're proud of, that we want to exclaim, that we want to declare? Now, the everyday. So what does this have to do with my life every day? I think maybe the first thing that we can do is look and see, where are the areas that I might be in danger of compromise? Where are my synagogues? No one goes to synagogue now because we're here. But where, what place in life would I hate to be cast out of? What circle of friends would I hate to be rejected from? What part of my life, school, work, home, what part of my life would I hate to lose? And those are the areas that we will compromise. Those are the areas that we will seek the glory that comes from people rather than the glory that comes from God. So I don't know where that is for you. And I don't know, honestly, where it is for me right now. Sometimes I think that maybe pastors in general, struggle with it up here. And that makes it a double-edged sword. And so I think the ability to be honest with ourselves is crucial. Where do we struggle? Where would we hate to be cast out of? And I know we don't end sentences with prepositions. I'm sorry, but it's just how I phrased it. So at least I acknowledge the rule. So, but I see it, so I guess my guilt remains. Living in rejection will at some point be where we're at. Hopefully it is. That's the idea. Hopefully there is a difference between us and everyone else. But that's where Jesus is, and that's the hope, is that on the outside, rejected is where we'll find Jesus and where he'll be with us, not with the powerful, but with the powerless. And this isn't to create some sort of holy huddle and us versus them. Jesus died for the world, the dark world that he was sent into. And that's what we're called to do. So some encouragement. John 15. If the world hates you, know that it has hated me before it hated you. And I can't, just reconciling this with God so loved the world. Like, is that our heart? Like, there's hatred, but there has to be love from us because that's the heart of the Father for the world that is lost, that's blind, that doesn't see Jesus, that doesn't worship him, that doesn't acknowledge him. So as you go in this week, I just ask to know where your area of struggle is, that synagogue that you would hate to be cast out of. And think, what would a life of worship in that area be instead? What would a life of worship look like? How would my thoughts change, my attitudes, my actions, how I imagine that space to be? How would that change? And know that if you are cast out and rejected, that's where Jesus is, and that is the best place to be. Let's pray. Father, we come before you, and we know that you are good. We know that you are with us. You've spoken to us. You've shown yourself in your Son, Jesus. God, I pray that you would take the desires of our heart and you would shape them to match yours, and that we wouldn't desire the glory and acceptance from others, but that what comes from you and you alone. You are good, and we love you. In your Son's name, amen.